Hello and welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime. Oh wait, I'm reading it off the page. That's cheating.
That's what I've been doing.
You can read it off the page.
We're allowed to read it off the page?
Yes, we're allowed to read it off the page.
Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor. I'm Pat Labor.
I'm Tucson Egan.
I'm Clayton Ashley.
Did you really think we couldn't read it off the page?
Yeah. I thought we were supposed to be doing it off the dome.
No, you can do whatever you want. Anyway,
man,
you know, I feel the TV like a host damn reading fool. off the teleprompter.
Yeah, exactly.
What?
Yeah,
that would be really cool if the news guys were just memorizing all that stuff. Drilling it in the mirror. A man was struck by a milk truck. A man was struck by a milk truck.
You mean Colbert's not just coming up with all those jokes off the top of his head on his own?
Were either of you people who thought that on Mystery Science Theater they were just making that stuff up as they went along?
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought it was like in one go somehow, and then they animated it later.
It was like, they're geniuses. Like, how do they do this? It was like, oh, they actually write and edit this stuff. Like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Craft.
Craft.
Speaking of craft.
Yeah. We had all manner of them in this week's episode of Pat Labor.
Craft. Vehicle craft.
We had
craftsmanship of this.
Yes. And craftsmanship. Because, yes, this was a well-crafted episode. My notes, so this was such, okay, this was episode 6 of Pat Labor, part 2 of SV2's Longest Day. And my plot summary of it is a shot-for-shot recap of the episode, because every single scene in this episode was about moving pieces around in this story.
Yeah. If you had to sum it up in like one sentence, it pretty much would just be "fuck it, we ball." That's really what it is.
Yeah, we ball wisely.
Yes, we ball wisely.
I was actually talking to Sant before we started that the amazing thing about it is that it keeps the Pat Labor tone.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time after episode one or part one of this, I was just thinking over and over, like, okay, I know this is going to be about a military coup, maybe a hot war. Like, we don't know exactly where this is going, but it seems pretty grim. And I was like, how are they going to balance that storyline with the, like, getting up to shenanigans, kind of like, you know, this is a crew of ragtag ruffians that, and it's silly and funny and charming, but also... pretty intense and dramatic. They just did it. Like, I don't know. They just wrapped it all in a neat bow.
This team of idiots just locked in. They locked in their own specific way, and each of them delivered like when it actually mattered. I'm like, wow, this is incredible.
Yeah, it was. So to recap for those of you who your memories maybe are a little hazy about what happened in the previous episode of the show, this is the second part of a two-part arc. A rogue element of the JSDF, the Japan Self-Defense Force, attempts a coup while the rest of the military is away doing little impact exercises with their United States allies. And the members of the SV2 Special Vehicles Unit of Tokyo come together to try to thwart the coup.
They're smarter than your average cop.
Yeah.
They just kind of seem to see what's happening a bit more than anybody else, which is their superpower, I guess. Like, it's interesting also that even when I sort of jokingly say, oh, how is this episode about these, like, silly oddballs who managed to prevent this from happening? But I think there's a point here that, like, starting with, like, the first scene, basically, which is that they're using the restaurant as cover. Like, a lot of their advantage is because they're unassuming. And because they have these, like, literal, you could almost call it, like, community connections. Like, this isn't a place where the local restaurant hates the cops. They actually like them enough that they will let them use the restaurant as their, like, cover for getting communications into other members of the team, for just, like, being able to get around the city without being discovered. Like I said, the superpower they have is just, you underestimate them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to your point about them noticing more and knowing more than... Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, wow, they're actually all very smart. I did love that. This is, I guess, sort of a spoiler for later in the episode. It's revealed that, like, there is a reason why Goto, the leader of this team, would recognize what was going on here and have suspicions about it. And it's because he was college buddies with the bad guy.
Yeah.
they it's used like, to roll I, together.
I know this signature. There's only one man who knows this signature. It's like, I have to meet him. Like, yeah, that's what it is.
Yes. And that man is named in this episode, I believe, for the first time, and it is Kyuteru Kai, and he is the leader of this JSDF coup. And so at this
point...
And
he was in the noodle shop. He was the guy in the noodle shop.
Yep.
He was the guy who Shinohara had spotted in the noodle shop. And at this point, it is established that this is definitely a rogue element of the JSDF. This is not the main central force of the JSDF attempting a coup.
Yeah.
It is...
Which is why they needed the rest to be at Limpac. Like, that was definitely...
Right.
Not just... That's not the only thing they were counting on, which we'll get into later in this. Because I mentioned the restaurant, so, like, this is... kind of the first thing. They're using the restaurant to literally deliver food to the rest of the team, most of the engineers who were back at base, to kind of like get a sense of what's happening. Specifically, Clancy is pretending to be like delivery girl. And it's great when she handles it so effortlessly. When like they're starting to like rush her, she just like starts complaining like, hey, they gave me a huge bill. I need to make change for it. Unless you got change, I'll take a discount off your bill. And he's like, I'll be right back. And it's like, you know, distracts him, totally believable. And she just thought that off the top of her dome. Mm-hmm. But
it's such a good cover. Yeah, this is the team that was left behind at the station when the coup happened. So they're all detained there. Mm-hmm. So the way that they're communicating is by faking a delivery or having Kanuka be the delivery driver and deliver noodles. And it's such a good scene.
And, they discover they're not any use anymore. They've sent what they could. They've scrapped what else they could. But they do have important information. Critically, there might be a nuke on the board.
Yeah, they might have a nuke. Like, what?
Yeah, they might be at 24 kills, ready to end the entire match.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So the team that is detained there at the headquarters says that they have reason to believe that there is a nuke in play, and it is because—is it something they overheard one of
they
the guards say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So that intel makes it back to the team, who is in communication.
And then just like, if this wasn't already a pretty tense situation, like,
right. So, we then, jump to Nagumo, who is the SV1 team leader, the leader of the much more competent team of Pat Labors. And she is being briefed by a couple of guys from higher up in the police chain of command. And
pretty critically, she's been taken away from what she was doing in the previous episode, which was kind of mounting the last defense of Tokyo.
Yeah.
The rebels had taken like three of their four main targets, not the military headquarters. Is that what we said?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they knew ahead of time, were able to prepare for it. So she's been drawn away from that to go talk to these guys.
Yes. And they give her some instructions, and those instructions are, collapse the garrison, give up, get out of there. So essentially they're like, you guys are going to break through the siege, but not to break the siege. You are going to get through the people who have laid siege to our buildings and get our guys out of there. Mm. And their logic there is that, again, and this is, Clayton, exactly what you're talking about, where the show still maintains the Pat Labor tone, because it is just so intensely bureaucratic and political, because their reasoning is that the JSDF has not moved in. Sorry, the greater JSDF has not moved into Tokyo to deal with this, you know, for political reasons. Mm-hmm. But if the police start fighting this rogue element in JSDF, that will be enough of a provocation for, you know, that to happen. And they don't want that to happen. They want to maintain control of the situation.
Yeah.
And notably, the people who are giving this command are not in Tokyo. They are communicating her via broadcast because they, and this is a thing that I'm still curious to see if there's a payoff for, but they just so happen to be out of town during the siege.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of this communication, they say, we can't give written orders right now, so we're deputizing you to take this task. So my suspicion
how convenient.
In that moment is like, they're working with the bad guys and they just want to do this. Mm-hmm. I we'll see.
But I almost wonder if there's that like Pat Labor more mundane reason, which is like maybe they heard about it and simply didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I feel like that's just as likely, if not more likely, given the tone of this show. It's just like, yeah, bureaucrats, they don't want to deal with shit.
And they also admit that this is a political decision. I mean, part of this is that the cabinet like is detained by these rebels in the Diet, and specifically have not given in like a request yet. And I noted this actually at this point, because we're also getting a lot of scenes of like the team traveling on airplanes, kind of like getting ready. But Japan, Greater Japan, is like operating semi-normally. I think that's an interesting thing about this, is that this coup has not caused people to go into the streets. It's not caused like a wider geopolitical reaction that we can really tell on the ground. Yeah. Everyone's just kind of like in a wait and see. This is weird, but we don't want to rock the boat too much. Kind of.
Boy. I mean, That's so familiar. Unrealistic.
Yeah.
That's on so January 6th.
I was taking a nap on January 6th, and my partner, when I woke up, was like, people stormed the Capitol. And I was like, what? I went through the rest of my day.
Are we trading brief impromptu January 6th memories? I want to share mine. I was in a job interview for Polygon. That was literally my last job interview. And I was like, man, that was a really good job interview. I feel pretty good about that. And then I turn, I see CNN on. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm not getting any work done today. I'm literally just like glued to Twitter and just like watching this shit play out. And that is the day that I got my verbal job offer.
Incredible.
You know, just like, yeah, I would love healthcare and money to buy food, because I don't know what the fuck's gonna shake out today. I'm just like, yeah, oh my goodness.
In addition to like telling them the status of the cabinet and like why the government seems to like be frozen, they also tell Nagumo that we also have more important information, which is that our U.S. allies have told us that a cruise missile was stolen from the military base while everyone was gone on this LIMPAC. Also, it was brought here because of LIMPAC. Damn, it's
a really U.S. subtle cruise missile. It's like, again, it is the instant karma of like, you know, military cavorting with the United States, right? It's like, we're doing this little thing with them. They bring a cruise missile. The cruise missile gets stolen. And now the cruise missile is pointed at us.
Yep. You even have a guy, I mean, just in the background being like, why'd they bring that into the country? Like,
they have reason to believe that cruise missile is now in possession of the JSDF rogue faction.
They tied into their thing. We can't risk open civil war. And also if the JDF takes sides and there's police shooting at the army and all that, then they'll probably have to say, we have a nuke. Here are our demands, and then we'll have a nuclear panic on our hands. There's like a lot of levels to this that mostly boil down to they are scared of acting.
Right. Yes. Yes. So at this point, the rebels haven't made any sort of demands or statements, right? They have done the occupation. So it is, that sort of lends even more spookiness to the situation. So like you said, the leadership is just trying to maintain this stasis for as long as possible with the hope of resolving it before it gets hot in public. And then Nagumo refuses the order, which is so Nagumo of her.
Yeah. I think she had a good reason for it. I mean, like from her perspective, like, yeah, if we just retreat, like people are watching us. They have like cameras out there. The whole nation is looking to us in order to like maintain order and actually say like, what should we actually do? And if we do that, then we're conceding ground that this is just normal and this is okay. And that the JSDF, like that gives them sort of like a, it's tacit consent to what they are sort of like doing and what they're demanding. And it was like, I mean, I get where she's coming from. I'm just like, I get where both of them are coming from, honestly. But honestly, I'm on Nagumo's like, side, because like, fuck these guys. Like, that's kind of
I don't like the government guys.
Yeah.
I do understand them being scared of acting when there's a nuke on the board. Like, it's not an easy decision to make.
No, it's not. Yeah.
She makes hers a lot more passionately, though. So I'm on her side.
And it's not until a little bit later in the episode, I guess they hadn't made their demands yet, but it's not until later in the episode that we know what demands this group is making.
Right.
And it's like, you can't let that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they, when she refuses, they accuse her of insubordination.
She says basically, I'd rather die than run.
Yes.
So not just refuses, but like, I will die for this.
Yeah.
When she makes that intent clear, they do point out that Kai, the leader of this faction, is old friends with Godo, the leader of Special Vehicles Unit 2, which I think it's a moment where it doesn't change her resolve, but it just plants that sort of seed of suspicion and doubt there because he had not told her that yet.
Yeah, she didn't know
that. He had this connection. And, you know, they send a security guard after her and she kicks his ass.
Did he say that they went to academy or like university or training? I wasn't sure if it was just old friends or there's something specific. I feel like
Kai was like Godo's senior and they went to school at the same time. Cause I think that at some point, like Kai is like, I taught you well, this sort of thing, kind of like the elder classman, underclassman sort of like relationship of that, of like his friends. Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. I don't have a clear read. My read on it was that like when they're younger, idealistic, like college kids, like they were like, they ran together. Kind of. But that's just,
I didn't get them as idealistic. I think they were both bad boys.
Oh, really?
Maybe that's really what it is. Like, they thought themselves as idealistic, but from the outside, they were everybody thought they were just like bad boys who were just like gears in the cogs.
This is actually exactly what I was going to say, which is that I like how small the details are and how slowly they trickle out. Last episode, I think we got an image of this big villain, the rebel. The news reporter said, this is the rebel leader. But I don't even know if we got the name. And I feel like we saw Goto like recognize him or something. But there's a little cue there that already it seemed like Goto knew a little bit more than was going on. And then this episode, I mean, right off the bat, Goto does seem to know more about what's going on, has suspicions. That's just interesting. So in this like very quick line, but this kind of bomb is dropped that like, oh, Kai and Goto went to college or, you know, they were friends. She didn't even know. It's like it catches us off guard in the same way because we're on his side. But it's like, wait, why? And the fact that even the rest of this episode, we're still kind of like not totally sure what the relationship was. And that's super interesting.
And Godo's attitude towards it is so Godo when she the next scene is she fucks up the security guard that tries to arrest her, and then she calls Godo and they have a chat where, you know, she's like, why didn't you tell me this? And he's more or less like, I don't know if it felt that important. And she's like, well, now the cops are definitely going to be after you. And his response is so funny. And I think he says, I'm awfully busy as it is. I don't know if I can deal with the police right now.
He is so goated. This man is so unbothered. He doesn't give a fuck. I love that about him.
He's never been this like dirty and disheveled looking either. Like, so I was going to say at this point, I'm like, I've only seen one episode of this series, but I just forgot the name. Slow Horses.
Yes.
On Apple TV. I got so many vibes of that main guy. Who's
Gary Oldman's character. Yeah.
Gary Oldman's character. Yeah, yeah. I was getting a lot of Goto, like, I think there's something there. And I would say that, you might, if you like spy shows about people who are underestimated, you might enjoy Slow Horses.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that before Nagumo like storms out, I mean, they're accusing her of treason. They're saying you're in league with the rebels. That's how you knew and were prepared to stop them. And also Goto has like gone to ground. He's gone out of context. So they were already suspicious of him basically. So her mentioning like that she trusts him or whatever is bad for her. And it's interesting when we're like wondering who these guys' actual allegiance is. The fact they're so quick to be like, oh, you must be in league with them. We have to arrest you right now. It's interesting.
There's the one part for the cliffhanger of the previous episode, where we see the standoff between SV-1 and the JSDF. Like, there's a scene of Kai. We don't know, like, necessarily anything about him, but he's sort of, like, he's, like, in the background shadows. He's looking at a map. There's, like, a lamp overhead. And, like, he just leans over and he just says, Godo. Like, he knows that the only person who could meet him where he is, I'm just like, I knew it had to be Godo. Of all people, like, he's the one who would have, like, seen this coming and actually done this stuff. Like, yeah.
So that's what that's what it was, is that if nothing else, we knew that this guy knew who Godo was.
Yeah.
But we're only just learning now that, like, okay, well, they knew each other and they were friends. Interesting.
I thought it was only they knew each other by reputation instead of, like, actual, like, relationship. Yeah.
Well, we're just going to pepper in my labor concept right now.
Please.
And it's a concept I know very little about because I've never done it.
We're all learning here.
The Wildcat Strike. Like,
interesting.
This is the moment where Nagumo refuses an order. Mm-hmm. And essentially, much like this rogue faction of the JSDF, makes the decision to go rogue, use police resources and connections and personnel to do what she thinks is right. And there's a concept in labor called the Wildcat Strike. Okay. Are you familiar with the Wildcat Strike?
No.
In name and very basic principle.
Me too. So let's read the Wikipedia page.
Please.
What I know is that a Wildcat Strike is a unauthorized strike, essentially.
That's basically what I know.
Yeah. So, you know, generally when a labor body goes on strike, does a work stoppage, that is with the approval of their union. Mm-hmm. And that is a process that takes a lot of internal politicking and oftentimes can only happen in very specific conditions. So, for example, striking is on the table during union negotiations when a contract has expired. Most contracts include a no-strike clause, which means that as long as that contract is active, the workers will not go on strike. You know, if there's labor disputes or anything, those will be settled between the employer and the union, but there will be no full-scale work stoppages during that time. Again, when that contract expires, striking is a tool that the labor union can use to sort of hang a sort of Damocles over the management to say, well, we are no longer beholden to this no-strike clause. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if we can't find a solution together, we very, very well may strike. When we're moving towards that in bargaining, that is a scary thing, right? Because, you know, you need to communicate with all the people in the unit with you to talk about the plan for, well, if we're not working, we're not getting paid.
Right.
How are we going to take care of each other? How are we going to get through this?
You have to have a vote. There has to be enough time ahead of that to present it as a contingency. It's like, we're not saying that this is going to happen, but if this were to happen, if A, B, and C were to happen, then we would enter into a strike. Would you vote for that? Like, and basically just getting buy-in from all the stakeholders who are within the union in order to sign off on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we can all say that from first-person experience that if you ever see a union, and maybe, you know, we're speaking to media unions specifically, but even any kind of union shop, a strike is never a quick decision.
No, it is
weeks, if not months, in the decision-making process with lots of communication to the members and voting. So it's not like it's rarely the case, if ever, that the members are like forced into it. And usually, as Pat said, it's only happening because management is refusing to even bargain and negotiate a contract period.
It's a last resort.
It's like a last resort.
Most of the time, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it is done. When it is done with the full support of the union itself. Mm-hmm. A wildcat strike is a scarier thing that happens a lot more rarely. And that is a strike that occurs without the official support of the union that the laborers are a member of. And they are obviously more rare because they are more dangerous. The workers aren't legally protected when it happens, which is, you know, a big thing to worry about. But also, you know, it creates tension between the bureaucratic body of the union itself and the workers underneath it. But there have been times throughout history where it has seemingly been necessary. Examples, in 1965, again, I'm just reading from Wikipedia for this part. Canada Post workers illegally walked out for 2 weeks and won the right to collective bargaining for all sector and public sector employees. This resulted in them throwing out leadership of the company union and forming the Canadian Union Postal Workers. So this is a case where they felt that the union was not actually representing them strongly enough and were able to use this completely unauthorized action to build a new union. So sort of a union coup.
But it's interesting that it's actually a power. Again, it's important to note that the power still resides in the people.
Right.
Right.
And a strike is still powerful if done this way, but it's just the risk is there.
Right.
Right. And then there are other cases, reading from the Canada section here. I like this one, is that in 2012, Air Canada ground employees suddenly walked off the job at Toronto Pearson International Airport, resulting in many flight delays after three workers were suspended for heckling Canadian Labour Minister Lisa Raitt. So this was a conservative Labour representative, or Labour appointee in Canada. And like, that's a situation where the union is protecting the workers' rights to heckle a person who is probably not working in their interest, but like, there are, you know, there are cases where the union also needs to maintain a level of sort of respectability, right, for working with the working with management, so that they can, you know, continue to say that they're coming to bargaining in good faith with them. And, you know, there are certain things like this, like if I was a union representative and this happened, like it's one of those situations where it's like, damn, they are morally right to do that, do what they did. And it doesn't bother me at all. But it's like, shit, this is going to get us in trouble. So, but in that case, the workers had the backs of those employees and stood up with them, even though the union could not take official action or would not support it officially.
This reminds me of a thing you often see, again, thinking of our experience, where we would see the you know, members of the public who were generously trying, asking, finding ways to help us, or what they might have assumed was helping us, and they would call for a boycott before the union had.
Yeah.
And then you put the union, like exactly as Pat's saying, who are trying to keep respectability with management to during bargaining.
Right.
And it might seem like, why is the member, the head of the union, asking us not to boycott? Like, come on, we're on your side, dude. And it sucks because we morally appreciate the stance taken there on our side. But the tools are most effective when they're deployed strategically, I guess, for lack of a better word. And the union's leadership will typically know when that is, but sometimes you get a wildcat strike because they don't.
And that's the thing that, like, I'm curious about in other unions, because our union structure was very flat, right? And like, you just used the term union leadership, which definitely conjures the image of, well, it's like a version of the leadership that you have on the corporate level, right? In my experience, it's not like that, right? Because the people working, putting in that work, are from within the ranks of the union itself, and are generally volunteered and voted on. And generally the thing that determines whether or not you're doing that work is whether or not you said, fine, yeah, I'll do all that stuff too. but like the meetings like that we have where decisions are made are generally very consensus based. And then anytime you're looking at an action like a strike or any sort of uniform action across the unit, it's not a, this decision it's made was made. It's okay. It seems like this is probably the next step based on the consensus we have in this room. Let's go talk to all of our people, all of our individual contacts within the union, and see if they have consensus there too. But I don't remember where I was going with that.
Well, you're talking about like how other unions operate, and I think
even
funny to think like how it's, you know, one part of this whole thing is communicating with your union. I mean, a lot of the people's classic image of a union is like a factory. So it's like a place where you all are. You also strike at that place to prevent it from functioning. And so like, again, the wildcat strike is, what's funny is I think the place I'd heard it the most frequently was, if I'm not mistaken, in the Expanse sci-fi series, in the books at least, because they would mention that wildcat strikes would happen. And I feel like sometimes it's not even necessarily about whether or not a union was voting on it, but it was more about like whether or not it was a strike within how the government allows a strike to work.
Right.
And I mean, it summed it up in like, when you're at the margins, even a union can be hard to like get recognized and function and have this kind of like adjudicated and you know, more thoughtful way of employing a strike. A wildcat strike is often also a desperation maneuver, because it's like, we don't have anything we know to do except we'll just not show up for work.
Yeah.
Right. And it is explicitly illegal, right? It's like, unlike striking with the approval of your board, with, you know, official, not your board, with your union, circumnavigating that is illegal, right? And that puts everybody at legal risk. You know, much like within a union, sometimes there are things that you do leading up to a strike that are like bad behavior at work, right? Not necessarily bad behavior, but it's like we're all going to change our Slack icons, or we're all going to change our names to this one thing on Slack, or we are all going to take lunch at the same time on this day. That's not technically a work stoppage, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the logic there is generally like, these are small actions, and even if they wanted to punish somebody for them, everybody did them, right? So you have this cover of everybody did it. Are you going to punish all of us? Do you really have time to do that?
And then you get a message where somebody floats the little known policy that your face has to be in your Slack icon in order to do that. So then you find ways to sort of circumvent that.
But so with a wildcat strike, you still sort of have a bit of that sort of like mass solidarity immunity, but not really, right? Because if the cops show up to a wildcat strike, they can hit you over the head and take you to jail and charge you. And even if they don't like do that to everybody, they can do that to enough of you to make a negative difference in your life.
Yeah.
So anyways, wildcat strike, never had to do one. Hope that I don't. Hope that our, but here's the thing. The National Labor Relations, National Labor Relations Board is the institution on which the sort of legality and illegality of labor stoppages is determined, right? It's both the thing that protects it and also the thing that outlaws certain kinds of strikes. Mm-hmm. And if that institution is continually eroded, you know,
all bets are off. Really, all bets are off, right?
Yeah. And there's a world where a wildcat strike is the only kind of strike.
Right.
And that's a scary world. Anyways, that's not what the Pat Labor people are doing, but they are going completely rogue and continuing to work as a unit outside of the chain of command, and taking the same risk that you would take in a wildcat strike, where they have agreed, like, this is the right thing to do, despite the fact that the system is telling us it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It also helps to have someone like Godot who sees when this is happening and when to call the shots. I think it's around this point in the episode that he gets in contact with Shun O'Hara. I think also just rubs in his face. He says, I saw the guy, I saw Kai at this noodle shop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it turns out to be important information, because that's when Godot can connect. Oh, if he was up there in Hokkaido at that time, he must have had to take a ferry.
Yes.
And then he starts. We don't really know where this is going, but that's just kind of like what he's thinking.
I love that they use his noodle order in order to confirm his actual identity. It's like, yeah, he was doing this shit, and he was like, just took it down like a champ. I'd never seen anything like that. I'm like,
that's totally and a bunch him. Of red pepper.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
No scallions,
like,
huh?
I was like, huh? Yeah.
I also love that we mentioned before the labor detour. Godot looks a bit like a dirtbag in this episode, and it is so good. He's got like the messy hair. Like I was like, what looks different about him? It's that his hair's not slicked back. It's kind of messy. Uh-huh. And he has his little round glasses on, and he looks so fucking cool.
Yeah.
I mean, he really uses the glasses, it feels like, at one point to get past a cop. But mm-hmm.
He's like, I really can't recognize that guy. Holy shit.
I feel like everybody is kind of being like the best version of their character. Cause next we get Clancy. It's Clancy who gets the giant gun, right?
I think so, yes, because she's American. She gets it from the Americans, yeah.
And I was trying to figure out like exactly how this worked, but I loved the I'm an American. I'll give you this information, but I don't want to perjure myself.
Yes,
she's such a weird American voice.
Yeah.
She gets some information from an American official working at the Air Command, the American Air Command in Japan. That what is the intel that she gets specifically?
Well, so I was confused about it, because then she's like, I ought to get some hush money for this. So I thought it was her telling him something she shouldn't have known. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, okay, don't tell anyone about this.
Like, I mean, right. If you give me something else, I won't tell anybody.
I figure it has to be something like that, because she got a giant gun out of this.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well,
so by her logic, I think, ready, she's already operating as part of a rogue factor. She's already fucked and in trouble. He's not. Mm-hmm. So she is in a position to threaten to bring him down with this as well.
Okay, it could be that too.
So
whatever it is, she's a badass here. And then it cuts to, like, after she says, I should get some hush money, it just cuts to this gigantic chain gun that's so big they have to pan to look at the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the line about, like, you know, I'm starting to think maybe Kanuka was banished here because they couldn't control her either.
Yeah, I'm just like, holy shit, you might actually be onto something.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the gun that they get is, it's supposed to be like the A-10 gun, the uh-huh. one that's mounted uh-huh. on the bottom of an A-10, which is just like one of the biggest.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Most, like, fuck-off miniguns ever created.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And Oda...
And they use it to great effect later.
The gun freak is looking at it, and he has the classic anime nosebleed. This is the character who is excited to shoot a gun in the first mm-hmm. episode, and he's just looking at it, and just both nostrils just pouring blood.
Oh my God. I thought... I genuinely was making the connection there that I thought he had the hots for Kanuka. He was looking at the gun.
Oh, it was the gun, dude. Yeah. He's horny for the gun.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, this next scene I also need a little help to understand because I think it's Goto doing something incredibly badass.
Yes.
But he steals an ambulance?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So in the scene before this one, he's on the phone with somebody on his car phone, and he's distracted during the conversation. Then we get a shot of a bus pulling out in front of him.
That's right. Okay.
Something else. We have another scene, and then we cut back to Goto's storyline. And there is a crew there looking at a flipped over car, and they're like, oh, we can't find the guy.
It's really funny.
And then the medics show up and they're like, hey, somebody stole our ambulance.
It's like, first they find the car and the cop's like, I don't know how someone flipped a car over like this.
Yeah.
Well, there's no one here, though, so I guess they're okay.
Hey, where's my ambulance?
Standing there, like, in shock, and you think he's going to, like, point at something behind the cop, but he's just standing there in shock, and then he's just like, my ambulance is gone.
Oh, my God.
It's really good.
So, so Goto is now on the move in an ambulance, a little banged up because he flipped his car.
But I guess the thing is that he was distracted by the bus. Not only was he, like, thinking too much, but literally the thing he was trying to think about was the ferry, and then he's like, right. Aha! Oh, no.
And this is where we get a really funny confirmation about a previous episode of this show, which is that the episode happened. and this is Goto calling in a favor from the detective who helped with the sea monster case.
Oh, I love a good callback. I love a good
detective
callback.
Matsui.
Yeah.
And they specifically say, like, hey, this is payback for when we helped you with that sea monster thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, my God, it really happened.
Yeah.
especially because the character now associated with it is this guy who feels like one of the most serious characters, most, like, straight-edge detective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
hard-boiled.
I will never not think about the fact that he's involved with the sea monster thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he squeezes that guy for some more information and learns that two ferries are missing, and gets helicopter or satellite images of the two boats, and they both appear to have missile launchers on the decks. And his conclusion is that one of these is the stolen missile and the other one is a decoy.
Because Goto knows how Kai thinks.
Yep. And that's a fun callback to the decoy missile launchers from the first or second episode.
Good thought, actually, yeah.
So,
and actually, speaking of Kai, the next thing he does is just calls him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just calls him.
Yeah,
Goto just calls Kai.
Yeah.
So he's talking to Kai, who is out on one of those two ships. And at this point, I don't believe we know which one he's on. And Kai threatens to fire the missile if any ships or helicopters or anybody comes close within a kilometer of his ships. So they are in a bit of a standoff here. Go ahead.
He also says that, like, 5 minutes before you called me, I sent my demands, so...
Right, that's huge, actually, yeah.
Don't know what they are, still, but he's just like, I sent them.
Yeah.
And so, if I don't hear back within a certain amount of time, I will also send the missile, so, like...
I did it 5 minutes ago. It's like the Ozymandias pool, where it's just like, I did
checks
it.
Checks in the mail.
Yeah, checks in the mail.
I mean, it's great how much, even at this point, these two characters are, like, they both just kind of keep pairing each other. Mm-hmm. Like, each one... is there for the next one's thing. It's like, aha, I knew Goto would be ready for this. I was expecting that. And then Goto's like, I knew he'd be on a boat out there and he'd have a dummy missile. And like, and it keeps going. But before this resolves, we have to do a little detour.
Mm-hmm.
A little action scene, right?
what does she say? It's time to get up to some trouble, or I want to raise hell.
Yeah,
I think it's
yes.
Yeah. I mean, what is the plan here? It's an incredible animation sequence, so I'm so glad it's here.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't ultimately amount to anything.
It's so funny how little it amounts to. Once again, at the beginning of this episode, you said that like this still feels so much like Pat Labor. And this is another moment. Like, this is the moment like when they have to ride a blimp to get over a bridge, mm-hmm. or do anything with a stupid anticlimactic ending. Yeah, they are fucking hauling ass down the highway on a flatbed truck with one of the two labors that they still have. And the labor is holding a minigun that's bigger than God. Tanuka is on a motorcycle, and they're running from these rogue JSDF helicopters. They go into a tunnel, and
the animation is sick because she knows, like, okay, the helicopter's threatening us, but it's not ready to attack yet. It's way too close.
Right.
Oh, well, now it's going around. It's definitely going to shoot when it comes back around. But then she knows, like, and the animation is very good. It's like there's a camera in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second they, like, get in the tunnel, just like whoosh, like, you know, a zoetrope effect,
yes,
or something.
I love that.
It's really neat.
Yeah.
And then she's like, okay, and now if they're smart, they're going to be waiting for us at the end of the tunnel. And they, like, shift position. So now she's, like, following them. We still don't know what the plan is or what they're doing, but...
We never will.
Nope. But it was cool.
She's like, when we get out of there, you start blasting. So we do have a beautiful sequence of this labor riding on the back of a flatbed truck, shooting a minigun. And the amount of shells flying out of this thing look like a carpet right there. So dense and close to each other as they eject from this thing. It's just a constant stream of bullets. They don't hit anything.
it chews through the highway, and it's cool looking, but it chews through it so quickly that it just becomes dust and rubble very quickly.
Yeah. And then here's a question. Did they blow up the highway with their minigun, or had the rogue JSDF guys already blown the highway as a block?
I think they blew it up.
I thought there may have been a point here that they were just trying to, like, that I thought Clancy was just trying to get by and that the big thing was a distraction.
Mm.
And she knew this would happen. And I'm not basing this off of what I read later, but on a wiki, like, recap, because I was a little confused about a couple points.
Yeah.
This one described it as she knew that by shooting the chain gun, they would not have enough speed to get over the jump, and that they would create the hole. I don't know how or why. I don't think I caught anything that said that explicitly, but
yeah,
they do chew a massive hole in the highway right in front of these rebel forces. Clancy jets her motorcycle over like a fucking Marvel superhero.
Nothing like a Jet 2 holiday.
It's... She just, like, flies over them, like, does a huge slide on the motorcycle, and then you're kind of like, oh, there's more forces in front of her. What's she going to do? And it's nothing. She
nothing.
Just gets caught.
Yeah.
All right, back to the actual important stuff.
Back to it. Yeah, and then the important stuff is cool, because we get a tiny bit of Pat Labor action.
I guess we have a little setup first.
Yes.
This is Goto. He doesn't say really how, but he has help from the Americans. Mm-hmm. But they want to keep it on the down low. They're going to deny involvement if it comes to that. But it's very, you know, vague about what it is. The only other kind of clue we get is it's like, I want Yamazaki to pilot this one. He can withstand the G-forces.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting here is, I think we skipped over this really quick, but back when they were getting Shinohara in on the plan, he mentions, first of all, they're getting the Alphonse, like, all repaired and gussied up at his dad's factory.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentions, like, oh, my dad wants us to get access to a prototype paratrooper aerial pattern.
From the previous episode, that blueprint that he was looking at, that was the thing. And Asuma is just like, he just wants to show it off so that he can sell it later. That creep. I'm just like, look, mutually beneficial solution is like, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah. I'm genuinely interested at this point, like, how much of a business plot this is going to end up being, in terms of, like, was this part of the plan?
It is weird. It's interesting. Cause I did think that his dad was a lot more involved, but it, You know, he's also just like, hey, the police want something. Why don't you give them that robot? You know, let them try it out. Maybe someone will buy that one. Yeah. Maybe it's a bit more innocent than that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The main thing here is he hates his dad. Mm-hmm. That was what I got. Like, it doesn't matter if his dad is actually being helpful. He still is like, what a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because, again, speaking of callbacks, do you believe a Pat Labor can fly? Because two of them are about to.
Yes.
But, I was referencing the fact that they got this because when they say Yamazaki can withstand the G-forces,
mm-hmm.
I did assume it was just like, oh, I guess maybe they need the Americans to help out with like a paradrop or something. But right. They're going to, you know, try to surprise them by dropping this in there. But that pretty clearly or quickly becomes like, that can't be the plan, right?
Right. Yeah. We do see, not quite yet, but we do see that, you know, moving sequentially. Yes, we know that a submarine has been lent and Yamazaki has volunteered for a dangerous deployment. We sort of have the heavy fate hanging over Yamazaki specifically because when he says goodbye to his family, that is given a bit more of a moment than the other characters. It's a bit more emotional and we're not sure why. So it's like, oh, geez, is he going to survive whatever's about to happen? And you're right. Yes, this is where Kai spots a Labor that is being carried by two choppers towards his ship.
Like very big and obviously, mm-hmm. And I was like, "That's really their plan."
Yeah, that can't be their plan.
And of course, Kai also says what we're thinking and says that's obviously a decoy. but he has no way of predicting what it is a decoy for.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we do have—I forgot—we have a little buildup here because mm-hmm. we have Goto and Matsui have a little like dramatic chat, mm-hmm. and this is where we finally get the demands where
yes.
it's like. Kai's demands are to dissolve the diet. That's bad. Ban all political parties. suspend the Constitution.
Huh?
No, I'm joking.
But you know, yeah, it's that he wants an end to the Constitution, which is probably bad. And he say is it all political parties or some political parties?
I think it's all political parties. Dissolved.
I think it's more funny than anything because it reads very much as like a 90s, almost like Ross Perot, like screw all the parties. Right. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Kind of thing where it's like there were some people, anti-government people that just thought if you got rid of political parties, it would solve the problems as though people wouldn't group mm-hmm. otherwise. Yeah. Like it's just this kind of like I'm trying to think of what the term is for it, but it's a weird thing to be annoyed at when you're also like, I don't want to die like a Congress
right.
or a Constitution.
Yeah,
it's like this is such a 90s villain thing where we were just in this, and not even just the United States, but apparently like Japan too, was in a headspace where it's like when you're thinking about the thing that the villain wants, it is the end of the system rather than specific view within the system, right?
Mm. Yep.
It was never like, This rogue faction of the military is doing some stuff on behalf of the Republican Party. It's like
mm-hmm.
this rogue faction wants to destroy every political party and
burn up the Constitution.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it was like a fear of anarchy more than a fear of totalitarian
mm-hmm.
takeovers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's probably what this is, right, for this character, right? Is like,
yeah, well, yeah, no, he seems a little just cynical and. I feel like if we ever understand more about his relationship with Goto, mm-hmm. we might understand more. But for now, he's just a criminal with a nuke
yeah.
on his
he
boat.
Seems like the kind of right. guy who'd be like, things would be better if I was running. I mean, things would be better if the JSDF was running things. And by the JSDF, I mean me. It's like, that's right. really what it is. Yeah.
kind of the villain from the senator from Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, right?
Where yes!
it's like when the mask fully comes off, he's like, I just want to return to cruelty. Like, yeah. I want...
I'm becoming the war economy so that I can end the war economy. I'm just like, everything that you said is like if you put every Metal Gear villain's like ideology into a blender and you just made it into a slurry and poured it into some man's head. I'm just like, I don't even think this shit is adding up. I'm just like, I feel like you're just riffing it off the dome right now. Like, what the fuck? Oh my God.
So it's do or die time. There's a Goto makes the call. That Kai is on the Safflower, which is one of the two ships.
Yeah.
And this is based on... Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask. Like, I don't know if I caught the reason why.
So, yeah, sorry. It's my bad. Let me clarify that. He knows that Goto is on the Safflower, which is one of the two ships. Mm. And both of the ships have a thing that looks like a missile launcher on it. And it is almost, I think, entirely a based on his knowledge of how Godo thinks. And it's that Godo would want to be close and in control of the real thing. He doesn't want to be off
Kai,
by the fake
Kai
thing.
Would be.
Yes, Kai. Yeah.
Okay.
Godo doesn't believe that Kai would leave the real thing up to fate or somebody else. He believes that he would be in control of it.
Yeah.
Before the moment, the one last thing with the detective and Godo's conversation is just the detective. He starts to get the sense that like Goto is really relying on what he knows about this guy and his team. And Goto is, he's saying things about how, like, you know, my main job as an officer is to protect people and never really do something unless you know it's going to protect people and be safe.
Right.
But sometimes you don't have that option. You just got to do it. And I just liked his last line, the detective, when he's just like, hey, you know, I have a funny feeling I may have to arrest you after this.
Yeah. Wildcat. Yeah, I wrote down some of the quotes. Even at 99% certainty, a police officer's duty is to avoid decisive actions if there's significant risk to human life. But sometimes it's too late for that. Yeah, his justification here is that the threat has been issued, the demands are completely unreasonable and cannot be allowed, and the result of not meeting those demands is a missile being launched, right? He says that whether they act or don't act, the result will be the same. So that is why he decides to do the very risky thing that they do.
And we shouldn't buy any more time or wait any longer because we have the element of surprise. It's the one thing we have if we don't act at the last moment.
Right. If you wait until the last moment, that's when they'll be most ready. Like, yeah, that makes sense.
Smart guy.
Yeah. Very smart guy. Go to the goat, man.
Yeah. So who wants to say the cool thing that they do?
You do it.
No, you do it.
No, you do it.
Clayton.
All right. So I think at this point, since I'd heard about like the sub is in position, I was like, are they going to shoot a damn robot out of an ICBM tube? Fuck yeah, they
Hell
are.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It rocks.
And it's great because this is the flying one that we actually haven't seen yet. And so the intention, I'll be honest. I was a little bit hoping they were going to actually just like punch right through the ship. That's maybe a little over the top.
Yeah.
Instead, what happens is it jumps like shoots through the air right by the boat. And then it does this like cool thing where you see it's like momentum stopping. But because it's the flying one, it's able to like maneuver and land perfectly on the boat right next to the launcher. Mm-hmm. It does. It's a you know, prototype. It's not perfect. It's weak enough to lose an arm in the ensuing fire when they realize what's happening. Kai also realizes what's happening and starts running for the huge button that we saw this establish in another scene. He has basically the giant fire button.
Yeah.
And he starts running over to it. One of his like guys, his henchman is like, no, Kai, don't do it. But Godo called it. He would absolutely just press the button and watch the world burn. But luckily, our man Yamazaki, he didn't say almost anything this episode, and it was foreboding, but they had their man.
Yeah.
They knew he could do it. He's crushing the like tube of the launcher, and it like pops open like a hot dog casing to reveal the United States Air Force, which I thought, again, another like very unsubtle point to like, we're the problem.
I loved this so much, man. Like, this is like, I don't know. It felt like, again, Oshii's shit.
Just
doing it, right? Like, there has been a preoccupation throughout this whole show with the gun, right? The gun and the weapon and the importance of the gun and the weapon. And the fact that the thing that happens in the climactic moment of this whole thing is not them shooting the boat. It's not them blowing up the boat. It is them using the strength of this machine to grab a weapon and squeeze it until it doesn't work. Like,
yeah,
that's fucking cool, man. It's so
I mean, there is still a big gun in the scene because then Noah,
that's true,
jumps down. And again, I feel like another nod. She just like shoves her military pistol through the bridge of the boat, very much like the episode with the video rental store. And it's just like, you're under arrest, which I love for her. I love that she still got to do her cool action landing and kind of fly. And then I know Kai is just like, yep, all right, they got us. And he says something that just kind of alludes to this being like 20 years in the making, finally.
What started with two people or something like that. And it's like,
yeah,
like, what the fuck? Like,
and it's like, I think they had a plan. I think they were both, I think Godo was bad, but we got this line on them the first time they were on the phone where Godo's like, Kai says, you can still join me. Come here and join me. Mm-hmm. And Godo's like, you know, I'm not going to do that. You know, that's why I became a cop. And so I feel like there's something there to like, they were both on the same path.
And then eventually those paths diverged at some point. And I was like, that's why I became a cop. It was like, I realized that this was not the way to go anymore. I went a different way.
I believed in the system,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. It's like, or I believe that like, as flawed as the system is, like, it's preferable to whatever the hell it is that you're trying to affect.
Your anarchy.
Yeah, what you're trying to affect here. Your totalitarian anarchic state. Like, what the fuck? Yeah.
So the episode ends pretty abruptly. We don't get to see within this episode the fallout of anything that's happened, whether anybody gets punished for these policemen going rogue, whether or not the people who issued the orders to stand down were working in cooperation with Kai, or whether they were just being extremely cautious. We don't know what happens to Kanuka on the other side of the bridge when when she lands there with the JSDF guys.
We did see the two guys who were in their little Pat Labor technical that flew off the bridge. They're both like in bad shape, but alive.
Yeah, yeah, they're alive. They're limping sure to away let us from know. The crash. Yeah.
So, yeah, as far as we know, everyone's alive, but are they arrested? Will they be rewarded for this? It's very interesting how it ended up, but just the last thing about this like animation sequence I wanted to say is that this was an unusual episode in that we got two like really cool animation sequences in one Pat Labor episode, but this one was even shorter. And that's the thing. Like it is this, I would be shocked if that whole thing is 20 seconds. If that of like really of it, gorgeous, fluid animation, incredible staging, you know, exactly everything that's going on and it looks sick and it can make a big political message in within the action sequence.
Yeah.
But it's so much, it's so such a small thing. And yet the payoff is so good because it's like, you know, the plan they've been setting in motion this whole time, the sort of resolution of whatever is going on between Kai and Goto. One of them is going to trump the other at some point. And it turned out it was Goto, but damn, was it like, I could see someone thinking it's not good enough. It's too short, but it's such a good payoff. It's so expertly executed.
Yeah. Such a fucking good episode. This is so good. I can't wait for the next episode, for the last episode. I'm just like, I when I was looking at the episode list, I was just like, why is this two-parter at the, like it's the penultimate two-parter. Why is it not like the whole thing? And I'm just like, oh, so this is like, this is the next episode is the falling action and sort of like the denouement or something like that. It's like, okay, cool.
Which is only a thing I think about TV series doing when they're like prestige television.
Yeah.
Like that's right. A thing HBO TV shows do, which is kind of wild for this 1989 anime.
Bring this to HBO Max. It's like Zaslav, like do one good thing and bring this to HBO Max.
God, this was such a good episode. And it was so Pat Labor, right? Like, even though it was moving so faster than any episode, it felt like Pat Labor.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'm wondering, in your Toussaint, you may know more about this, Clayton, you too.
Mm-hmm.
Did Anno cite Pat Labor as a big influence for Neon Genesis?
I don't know if he cited Pat Labor as a... as an influence. I think it may have just been something that sort of exists within sort of the contemporary zeitgeist of that time. When you think about the things that influence Anno, is like it's a lot of Ultraman. And once you realize that, I'm like, oh, all that religious iconography is starting to make a little lot of sense because Subabar, like I can't remember like his like not only just that, but also he became like a Catholic. The creator of Ultraman became a Catholic at some point. And like there's a whole episode where like Ultraman gets crucified on a hill or some shit like that. I know somebody listening to this is gonna be really pissed off me because I'm quoting this out of context, whatever, and it's like I haven't watched Ultraman. All I know is that, like, Anno fucking loves Ultraman. absolutely mm-hmm. loves Ultraman. Obviously, that's the reason why he made Shin Ultraman. It's like, or like produced it or something like that. Yeah.
That you actually did remind me, though. I wanted to bring up Shin Godzilla.
Yeah.
That was why I was Shin bringing it up. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Because that is the thing I would most like recommend somebody who like, at this point now, I think one of the things I've seen, at least out of Japan, that most reminds me of Pat Labor is Shin Godzilla. And it's focus on bureaucracy. And even it's kind of focus on like the outsiders being the ones who can solve a problem that like a more static bureaucracy can't.
Everybody is paralyzed by protocol, and we need to lock in as these like sort of like weirdos on the periphery because we are not beholden to precedent necessarily. We just have to get the shit done. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not about it's neither one of them is about going rogue, right? I mean, I guess the Pat Labor in this case was about sort of going rogue, but like in Shin Godzilla, they don't go rogue. They just like pull out, they call it this. That's the thing that felt so familiar about this one is the amount of call in favors that happens, right? Like how much it acknowledges that part of the political sphere where it's like this episode gets done and they get this thing resolved because they call in favors from all of these people who they have worked with.
And I feel like that's both savvy from like a storytelling position, but also for the fact of like, that's kind of just how the anime industry works. Like everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody. Like the whole reason why like the show Spy Family even happened is because the two studios that were like co-producing that, like both of the CEOs or like heads of whatever, they just met at an event and they just wanted to work together and they just did that. And it's like, that's really what it is. Or sometimes they'll have like, can we poach this one animator in order to work on this sequence and we'll bring him back like later or something like that. It's like, no, we got these deadlines and other stuff like that. It's like, there's a lot of politicking that goes on behind the scenes when it comes to anime, like production, that I feel like parallels with like this whole government bureaucracy bullshit. And I'm just like, we only have so much money in order to make this shit work. How do we make it work? Like, that's really what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a great episode of Pat Labor. And we have one more of these, short series left.
And then we have the movies.
The movies.
And then we have the show, which is its own continuity. But we'll get to that later.
It's going to be a pivot, but I'm excited about it because I know how much more of it's a slice of life thing.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the slice of life stuff in this series too.
I do too. So like, yeah, it's great. Yeah.
But I guess this has been another episode of Pat's Labor. It's a podcast from Rogue.site, which you should definitely be checking out every day because I know the folks who write are working up stuff every day and it's cool. I see it. I would say what's going up now, but this podcast is going up in weeks, so it won't be accurate. But it's a cool website all the time. I know that for sure. And we appreciate you especially for subscribing. If you're in the tier that gets you the video podcast, stay tuned for that. But for the rest of y'all, I am Clayton Ashley.
I'm Tucson Egan.
And I'm Patrick Gill.
Toodles.
Bye now.
See ya.